Good morning. Thank you very much for coming. My name is Charlene Lee. I'm with Forrester Research, and I'm going to be talking about social strategies for revolutionaries. Now, I picked this topic partly because, well, there's a room full of revolutionaries here, I believe. You are the vanguard of the social media revolution that's happening today. And what I'm going to be talking about are some of the new things that are coming up in a book that I'm going to be publishing next month with Harvard Business School Press. But the idea behind the revolution that we're facing today is that there's a lot of things happening, and the thing is that people are really getting together because of these new social technologies that are available. And what they're doing is they're fomenting revolution in amongst themselves, and businesses are having a really hard time dealing with this. So let me give you an example. Does anybody know what this number is? Does it look familiar? Okay, quite, again, this is a great audience. This is the number that was put onto a blog on April 30th, 2007, and it appeared on the rud-o.com website, a blog, and it's the HD-DVD processing key. It was the key that you could use to go and break the lock on all these DVDs. Now, this number was actually posted onto Dig, and the various industry people said to Dig, you need to take this number down, in which case they actually complied. Henceforth came a big revolution on the part of the Dig members who said, look, we're not going to do this. You cannot really put this down. And in the end, Kevin Rose had to go and write an apology saying, look, you know, we're going to let this go. But it's wherever the cards fall, they fall. Here's another example, just a small one, that some of you may have been seeing playing out. When CBS took Jericho, a pretty fun show that people really liked, it took it off the air. And then people decided they weren't going to stand for this. And so they decided that they were going to send nuts, not just any nuts, to CBS. They were going to send it to one person in particular, Nina Tassler at CBS.com. And 20 tons of peanuts showed up in her office, addressed to her personally. And this is revolution again, and they were blown away. They had no idea when they canceled the show that people were so enamored with the show. And so they brought it back on the air. Now what happened was this didn't come out of nowhere. It had a revolutionary behind it. And that person was by the name of Sean Daly. He was an online talk show host in Las Vegas, and he was a huge fan of Jericho, and he didn't want to see it die. And he understood more than anything else that you needed to have something visceral, something physical and apparent that CBS couldn't ignore. It had to be something actually tangible, not just an online petition or people writing about in the blogosphere. So they won that fight. Jericho's back on the air. They've aired, I think, 4 or 5 different episodes. Done okay. So the revolution started out great, had a lot of fizzle behind it, but where is the beef? It hasn't really turned out. It's okay. It's not doing great. They are, you know, competing against things like a Democratic campaign and elections going on too. So there's a lot of things competing for the attention of the audience. But right now, CBS figured they had nothing to lose. They could actually satisfy what was going on. Had no risk behind this. Developed property already. So let's give it a try and see if this actually works. What's happening here are all these social technologies coming into bear, and we call it the groundswell. It's the title of the book, and let me read to you the description of it. It's a social trend in which people use technologies to get the things they need from each other rather than from traditional institutions like corporations. And the key thing here are the words each other, because that's really what's going on here. These technologies have been around, and people have been around online, but they've never been able to mesh together to create these new movements. Now, the key question, though, is this has been going on for a while. As we sit here in these chairs today and go through this conference, we kind of feel like we're on the cusp of something here. I don't know if you feel it, but I feel like, you know, we've been talking about this revolution happening, and finally, the corporations are getting it. They're actually listening and saying, yeah, you know, we believe this revolution. We don't want to make these mistakes in the past. We want to embrace this groundswell, and we're trying to figure out what to do it. You probably see it and you go back to your offices and your manager comes in and says, hey, let's have a blog. And the person is clueless about what it means to have a blog. Or they're saying, let's get into the social networks. Let's go do a social network or something. And they don't really understand what's going on, but they desperately understand. They can feel it, that they need to get involved, but they don't know how. And people who have been in this space, we kind of look at that and we go, ew, I don't want to deal with this because you just don't get it. It's going to be a painful, long process to bring you aboard. So what I'm thinking and seeing right now is that we're at a new stage here, that the question becomes, are you going to be a radical like a Thomas Paine? So for those of you who are not from the U.S., I apologize for the historical references here, but Thomas Paine was a revolutionary during the Revolutionary War, and he wrote this little pamphlet called Common Sense in the January of 1776. And what he wrote in there really galvanized the colonists to rise up against tyranny, against King George. And what he did was, he did that, he really was the foundation and the founding spark that lit off the American Revolution. But he didn't stop there. He went on, he continued to foment revolution anywhere he could go. Well, the American Revolution was done, so where do you go after that? He went to France. And he got to France, joined the French Revolution, and promptly got thrown in jail. Came very close to being executed. Thomas Jefferson was a huge fan of his and actually brought him back to the United States. But when he came back here, it was already over. The revolution was over. He didn't have a role anymore. The radical had no more voice. He didn't have anything to rail against, but he continued to try. And in the end, he had such a radical tone that nobody really respected him anymore. And in the end, he died. Only six people showed up at his funeral. And the obituary written in the New York Post at that time said he had lived long, did some good, and did much harm. So that's where Thomas Paine ended up. Let me tell you the story of another Thomas, of Thomas Jefferson, who was a revolutionary. There's a difference between being a radical and a revolutionary. And what did he do? Well, he wrote the Declaration of Independence. So he was also a voice for the revolution. He also became the third president of the United States. In the end, again, he was a very strong proponent, I said, and supporter of Thomas Paine, of that voice, of that radical. But Thomas Jefferson did something very different. Instead of standing on the street corner railing against the establishment, he actually went into the dog days of summer of 1776 and had to work with this group, the Second Continental Congress, which was just a nightmare. It was hot, it was Philadelphia, and it was a boring, tedious process to get all these colonists from 32 different colonies to agree on what independence meant. They had to bang it out over a whole series of discussions. He went off over the course of 4 weeks, and through the various mechanisms, actually worked it out. So here's two different type of revolutionaries. One who really had the vision, but couldn't actually deliver. Another one who also was very eloquent in the way that he articulated the revolutionary spirit, but had the actual process and the frameworks to actually pull people together. And that takes me to my theme, that to make revolution stick, you will require frameworks and process. Because frankly, it's great to have the ideas, but unless you can put them into practice, it's not going to go very far. And we are at that point today, I believe, where many companies and organizations and governments really want to take part of this process. They want to become and embrace that groundswell, but they don't know how. And I believe it's up to the people who are in this room, who are interested in this space, who have been living it, who are going to make this become a reality. So I'm going to talk about three things today. What are those processes that you need to use to create a social strategy? Second of all, who are these revolutionaries who are doing it today? I'm going to give you a couple examples of real people who are doing this inside companies. And then third, I'm going to talk about a case study and how to get started. So let me talk about that process. I call it the POST process. And the reason I like POST is because it's an easy to use acronym. When I break things down into little letters, I can remember them. So let me tell you what POST stands for. First of all, there's P. That means for people. You always have to start with the people you're trying to reach, the groundswell that you're trying to talk to. And you need to assess what your customers are actually doing, what their social activities are. The second thing is to talk about the objectives that you're trying to reach. Really, what are you trying to accomplish? I can't tell you how many times I go and talk to companies and organizations, and they come and say to me, well, we need to have a blog. And I go, great, glad you're thinking of this. Why do you want to have a blog? And that then follows sort of a long and awkward silence. Usually, sometimes they even say, well, because my CEO wants one. And I go, well, that's not a good enough reason. What are the objectives? And I'm going to take you through that. Then you talk about the strategy. Once you know where you want to go, how are you going to get there? And it's not a strategy, just what I'm going to do today, but also what I'm going to do in the future, because your relationship with your customers and the people you're trying to reach in that groundswell is going to change. So your strategy is going to have to change with that relationship. And then finally, at the end, you think about the technology. You decide based on the people, the objectives, and the strategy, which technologies you're going to use. Because frankly, any of these technologies can be used in so many different ways that it doesn't make sense to start with the technology first. You need to think about the relationships you want to craft first and then think about the right technology to use. So let me talk about people, for example, for a minute. When you think about social activities, people often say, well, It's when people are blogging or when they're using wikis or using RSS or in social networks. And of course, so we think about it in a slightly different way. We think about it as a ladder of participation. And so at the very bottom of the ladder are online adults who aren't active in social technologies at all. One level above that are people who are spectators. And these are people who are on the sidelines. They're reading blogs, they're listening to podcasts, they're watching the videos on YouTube, but they're not actively participating in it yet. They're definitely enjoying the fruits of social media, of that engagement from the groundswell, but not actively participating in it. One level higher participation level are the social networks, the people who are joining them. And so they're engaging with their friends, they're participating in there and doing all the great things they can do on those places. A level above that are the collectors. Small group right now, but these people play a really important role. They're organizing all the content that's on the social net. So they're taking RSS feeds, they're bookmarking pages, they're digging stories. Then there are the critics, the people who are participating in discussion groups, editing wiki pages, but also writing on comments on blogs, adding comments to videos on YouTube. And then at the very top are the creators, the people who are actively engaged in writing the blogs and creating the podcast, creating those videos. And I think for those of you who are in the room who are creators, and I imagine many of you are, you know that there's a very different type of mindset separating people who are spectators from becoming people who are being creators. And what we do is we have a lot of data at Forrester, and this is what we see. That's exactly what happens. So at the spectators, about 48% of adults are at that level, and about 18% of online adults are creators. Now, I know there are some math whizzes in the room, and you're looking at this and saying, well, it doesn't add up to 100%, and that's because it's not a segmentation. It's a categorization. So I'm a creator, I have a blog, but I also watch videos. I also am a collector because I bookmark things, and I dig stories. I'm also critic, I add comments to blogs. So I'm active across the spectrum on many different topics, on many different ways. And when you see youth, they're off the charts, as you can imagine. And we look at youth primarily because it's an interesting group, but also because they're the vanguard of the future. So I do anticipate that as we do this research and as we continue looking at this, it's going to change. It's going to be fewer and fewer people who are inactive, and they're moving up that ladder. And the question becomes, what does this, we call this a social technographics, what does the social technographics of your audience look like? Because if you're trying to put in blogs for them to write on, but very few of them are creators, then you may have to rethink that strategy because they're not going to accept it. They're not going to be active in that space, and that whole strategy is going to fall on its face. I'm going to put up some data here in terms of how the social technographics spread out by age. And for those of you who are interested in scurrying down the numbers, I'm going to post these slides up on SlideShare after this, so you'll be able to look at these slides directly. But the data you can see here, it definitely changes across as people get older. They become less and less active. And I think there are two reasons for this. First of all, it just takes them longer to adopt new technologies. And second of all, the content that's up there today isn't exactly geared for them. So you don't see a lot of boomers on Facebook or MySpace or actively reading and writing blogs because a lot of the content isn't geared for them. But that's changing. One thing to point out, if you look at the older boomers, the second to the last column on the right, you can see that 39% of those who are online, who are between the ages of 51 and 61, again, in many cases, the parents of the people in this room, they're actually using this content. They're actively engaged as spectators. So they're reading the blogs, they're watching the videos on YouTube. And it's not going to take very long for them to say, okay, I want to comment on those and become critics. Or I might even try my hand at creating a video or a podcast or writing a blog. Soon they're going to become creators too. So again, I don't think it's everyone who's going to be participating across all of these channels. And in fact, your participation may change depending on what's going on in your life. But it's important to understand if you're trying to reach people, what their level of participation is. Now, the second part of POST is objectives. And I want to talk a little bit about that. Because right now, the roles that people have inside the organizations really are very specific. But I think in the groundswell, these objectives will change. Let me give you an example. A lot of companies do research. And research is great. You go out there and survey, do focus groups. But in the groundswell, there's a way to do that differently, and that's to listen in a very different way. That you can go into these communities and through various tools and forming your own communities, you can actually learn much more about your customers and what they're doing in an ongoing way. The second thing to do is to do marketing. Traditional marketing is about sending out a message or supporting a brand. And in many cases, I think about that as shouting at your audience. Because you're not really talking to them, which is what you would normally do with a groundswell. in terms of you sending out a message and then listening. That's a conversation that happens. I think marketing is going to be changing because of the groundswell. The second thing is sales. If you think about what sales is happening, it's all about getting people to buy a product, about you going out there and selling it. But what if you could get the groundswell, the people, your customers to sell on your behalf, to allow them to talk about it? And we call that energizing. And then there's support, there's customer support when people have problems. They call you as an organization. But what if your people, your customers could support each other? Again, supporting and actually providing the information and the services that your customers need, allowing them to do that themselves. And then finally, there's development, both in product and also in process and the service development areas. And oftentimes, it's a closed process that a company has. There's a product development group over there on the side. What if you could embrace your customers and actually bring them in, open up that firewall, and pull your customers into the process? And what I'm going to do in the next section is really talk about how some revolutionaries inside companies are creating these social strategies, and in particular, against these objectives. I'm going to start with actually with the talking objective. And this, some of you may know, Will It Blend, where they're actually taking these various things, see some nods in the audience, and they're throwing them into a blender made by BlendTech to see what blends up. And this is something that was suggested by people, and they were blending up an iPod. So let me just highlight a few things for you. When I took this screenshot, they had over 4.6 million views of the product. They also had people recording videos back in terms of commentary. They weren't just writing back. They were writing commentaries back, showing their BlendTech, hopefully not granting up their iPod, but doing other fun things and expounding about how much they love their blender. And then also, again, what they decided to do was to have, again, all those wonderful embeds. So this became highly viral, too, as well. Now, what was the marketing genius who came up with this idea? Because frankly, it has worked. BlendTech has increased their sales of blenders by 25% to the consumer market. And these are $400 blenders. They make great smoothies. So the thing is, this was brought up together by George Wright, the VP of marketing. He spent $50 on the first videos that they had. He walked into their lab, which is where all the videos are made, saw some sawdust on the floor, and said, hey, if people could only see this, see what the blenders could do. And he had an idea, but they can. So let's use YouTube. Let's take our video producer. Let's go make these videos. And they're not, you know, they're nicely done, but they're not like highly slickly produced. They're kind of kitschy, actually. And he spent $50 on materials, buying Coke and cooked chicken, and later on invested a couple hundred dollars on an iPod. But think about the value that added. And now George Wright, is he a social media guru or something? He was actually the VP of marketing when he came into this job, was brand new. Before this, he ran marketing and public relations for a steel mill. Not exactly the font of and the focus of social media out there. So in many ways, he just started thinking about how to use these things, use these social tools in a very different way. Let me give you another example of a revolutionary. This is Dan Black. He's the director of campus recruiting for Ernst & Young. Yes, EY, the accounting firm. And he is one of the most visionary revolutionaries out there in social media today. Because what does he do? He actually uses Facebook to recruit college students. Kind of natural idea, right? A lot of companies are using Facebook to reach a lot of that college audience. Well, he does it in a very different way. They created the page, and he found that people were writing on the wall. Students were writing on the wall, asking questions like, how many days off are there? Why should I be working for EY? Asking all these questions. And he took it upon himself to go and answer them back. So here's a conversation that was happening between him and Garrett and Kelly. And he's writing them back in a very personal tone. And it appears on the page for other people to see. And they were asking, why do you not recruit on my campus? And he explains why, but we still really want to talk to you. Now, he is the head of recruitment for all of North America for EY. He's not some person just working on the staff. He runs the whole thing. And in fact, his head rolls if they don't hire 3,500 college students every single year. So why is he doing this? Because he realizes that this is one of the few channels where he can have a direct conversation with his audience, college students. And frankly, no one else is doing this. I look at all the different pages that companies have on Facebook, all the different groups that they have, and there are very, very few times when companies actually put a human face in front of them. They still think of it as a brand, as a channel that they can go and market to, versus this is a place where you can actually have a relationship and have a conversation with the people you most desperately want to reach. So Dan is a revolutionary here, inside an old stodgy company like E&Y, and they're doing great with this product. Here are two other revolutionaries, Gary Colling and Steve Bent at Best Buy. These guys were in corporate marketing at Best Buy, and they realized that they didn't have a strong connection to the people who were on the floor in the stores, the blue shirts, as they're called, at Best Buy. So they decided to start a community, a social networking site called Blue Shirt Nation. And here's a screenshot of what it looks like, the front page. And what they wanted to do was really allow people to go and talk about what was happening so they could put those insights in and use it for marketing purposes. Well, what they found, it wasn't that great for understanding insights, but it was great at creating a support system for those employees and also giving them a voice, which they never really had before. So some of the things they advocated for, well, let's get email to every single employee out in the stores, even if they're part-time employees, so they can communicate with their customers. Looking for a product, can't find for you, let me email you back, is what they would say to the customers now in the store. And they could do this because they now had all the email. Why couldn't it happen before? Because somebody had thought that it was going to cost hundreds of millions of dollars to get email to everybody. Somebody saw this happening on Blue Shirt Nation, was an analyst in the finance department, figured out that it was going to cost maybe a couple tens of thousand dollars, less than $100,000 to enable this. So they made it happen. Or somebody saw that a display case wasn't fitting inside the store, posted up a picture, and somebody 2 hours later came back and said, hey, you know, I designed those display cases. They sent you the wrong one. Let me go back and make sure that the manifests are correct, make sure that you get the right things stripped out to you, and let me make sure that all the other display cases got to the right stores too as well. 2 hours. How long do you think it would have taken for that display case otherwise for that person to figure out it was the wrong case in the wrong store and to find the right person back in corporate to get the right case there? It would have taken weeks, months. We could probably be still looking at that out-of-place display case in that store. So again, what this has enabled are the customers and the employees themselves to actually support each other. Let me give you one other example. Josh, he's right here. And so you can see what his description is. He's a technology evangelist at Intel and also the geek blogger. And one person inside the internal intranet has said, you know, wouldn't it be great for Intel to have its own Wikipedia? And the discussion boards were saying, oh, it'll take 2-3 years to do this. It'll never happen. And Josh was thinking to himself, well, you know, I'm kind of techie. I can get servers, you know, I can probably find a server someplace and I can probably get this done in a day. So he did. He didn't wait around to see what would happen. And then he sent an email at the same time to John G. Minor and say, hey, you know, I'd be interested in doing this. But John's kind of a busy guy and it took him about 2 weeks to get back to Josh. And then when he did, he said, hey, you know, I want to talk to you about getting your server and everything. And Josh said, hey, I already got it up and running. I've got all these people contributing to it. And Josh was saying, you know, it was one of my best moments when I could actually say to him, I got it done. So that's a revolutionary spirit. And I think this is a screenshot where you can see at the front page, it's already become a very much well-used tool for the people inside to be able to support each other again. One last example here. And then this is from Steve Fisher. He's the VP of platform at Salesforce.com. And his goal in life is to make that platform as good as possible. And so what they decided to do was to get the people who are customers of Salesforce to actually contribute their ideas on how to improve it. And one of the most hated things about Salesforce.com were these banners, these things called saw banners that would come down and drop over the minute you signed in. And they were this great marketing tool for people inside of Salesforce.com to say, here are new coming events, here's Salesforce, the user conference coming up. By the way, did you see new features? And people hated it. So how much did they hate it? They put it up there as a suggestion, and 6,000 people immediately said, we don't like this. And so Steve, what he said, you know, we knew this is a problem, but this was like the preeminent place for our marketing, internal marketing people to market and communicate with their customers. We couldn't take it down until we saw this. This helped him make the case to people internally at corporate marketing that the saw banners had to go. And it still took them a couple months. It took them about 7 or 9 months to actually get the political will internally to make this happen. But what it did, having that input from the groundswell, being able to embrace them in that product development process, gave them confidence that they were making the right decision, that they could find other avenues to communicate with people. They could see how vehement people were hating these saw banners. And it gave Steve the ammunition and the confidence to go and make these changes happen. So I want to talk about the last part. How do you get started transforming your organization? I think the first thing, again, is to go and look at posts, that process. Follow that process in the way that you feel is the best way to actually give you some frameworks and process to do this. The second thing I'd like to do is to talk about how one company did this. And this is Lalo Menchaca from Dell.com. And he was the perfect storm to help transform Dell. So who is he? Well, first of all, when he started out at Dell many years ago, I think it was like 17 years ago now, he was a product technician. So he was on the technical team. He is an engineer in background. He understands how products work. And he was a great person to have because he understood so many of these things that worked. The public relations department said, you know, we need somebody to run the product reviews for people like PC Magazine. Can you come in? Because you understand these things. You can talk to the press about it and explain it to them and help them through that review process. So he became a lead person on the product review PR team. And he was there for 14 years. And then also, because he was going around to all these different departments, he knew everybody at Dell. He knew all the product managers. He knew all the engineers. And I think of Lino as a perfect storm for the revolutionary that Dell needed at that particular time. So you may remember back in the summer of 2005, there was a little small thing going on called Dell Hell. But Jeff Jarvis was railing against it, and it seemed like the whole blogosphere was against Dell because they had a lot of, the products were breaking, customer service wasn't good. And so what Lino did is he started the blog resolution team. He would go out there and find all the problems that people were having in the blogosphere. He had a customer service and a product development, product technician team to go and solve every single one of those problems. And slowly, person by person, they started to actually change the attitude towards things. And then he was also the right person to turn to then to say, hey, let's start a blog. Let's really start that conversation. We feel more comfortable now that we have something to say. And so they launched a blog in the summer of 2007 and six. And this is one of the first posts that they had. And it didn't get off to a very good start. Let me just read this to you. It says, you can't get this stuff off the shelf. So the guy was talking about how the XP700 was a great computer. The chassis is custom made. And somebody wrote back in a comment that you can't actually get this computer even. So what happened was, it was really discouraging. A lot of people were very down on the blog, and he was sitting there reading all the comments in the middle of the night about 1 o'clock in the morning. One comes through from Michael Dell. What do you think Michael Dell is saying? Like, what have you done to my brand? No, he's saying actually, keep at it. This is exactly what we need. We need to be out there talking to our customers. Lionel had the support of Michael Dell from the very top of the company to keep doing this. And what that gave him the confidence the next few days to actually change what the blog was doing. He read all the comments, took it to heart, and said, okay, we need to have a different conversation. And this is the post, I think, that really did it. This is the Flaming Notebook post. It was really audacious because at that time, a notebook had actually caught on fire in Osaka a few weeks before. And he said, you know, this is going to be the point where I talk about it. I'll say this is, we acknowledge that something's happening, we're looking into it. And it started this whole conversation where the customer service aspects of dealing with a battery recall in many ways was played out on the blog. And it set the tone for the blog going forward. Now, a lot of people in Dell were like, what are you doing? You're talking about our notebooks catching on fire, how dare you? And Lana was kind of like, well, they are. What are you gonna do, ignore it? We have to acknowledge it. Now, some people say this is the oldest PR play in the book. Yeah, we know it's happening, we're looking into it. But even just those simple comments made such a huge difference, I think, and this is a turning point for Dell. This is when it started transforming itself. Because what happened is a lot of people started coming to the blog. And Lano said, hey, this is a great opportunity. I can get all these other product managers who are sort of down in the weeds looking at their own product to come online, write a blog post. And then he was a little bit sneaky. He said, you know, once you're on there, you really need to pay attention to what the comments are saying about your blog post. And by the way, here's a monitoring tool that you can use to go and track what other people are saying on other blogs. Product manager by product manager, team by team, because Lionel had developed all these personal relationships with them, were now getting in sync. They were starting to transform themselves as a company, person by person, because of the efforts that Lionel was doing. He didn't keep the blog isolated. He didn't say, I'm going to be a blogger with a small team. He decided to spread that mindset throughout the organization. Now, interesting thing is, it takes time to change an organization. But Lionel kept at this, and Michael Dell kept at this, that executive support and that revolutionary working together to do this. So some of the things that they've done, they've actually put in an idea storm very similar to the Idea Exchange. In fact, it's on the same platform. And one of the first ideas they got up here was to sell a Linux-based PC to consumers. fact, 35,000 people said, let's go and do this in the first 2 weeks. And so what did Dell do? They said, okay, well, what version of Linux do you want? And they said, Ubuntu, the community said. And they said back to the community, well, how kind of support do you want? And they said, hey, we're Linux. We can support ourselves. We don't want any support. And in the course of 9 months, they launched this product. I'm sorry, 2 months, they launched this product. And usually it takes between 9 and 12 months. So 60 days, they had the product from beginning to end. That's an unbelievable speed for them to be able to do this. Total transformation of the way the company worked. And even more so, one of the innovative things that they're doing, they actually have a blog now for their investor relations team. Now, when I go and talk to investor relations people or legal people, they're usually the people who are most adamantly against social media because they're so terrified about what does it mean to be able to talk about all these things. I'm just opening up the possibilities of SEC investigations. Or my legal team says, you can't do this because of the legal risk. Well, Dell said, let's just put it all out there. So they have the IR team blogging about what the company is doing. They know what they can say, can't say, and they're empowered to do this without any sort of review, legal review on an ongoing basis. So I think what you've seen is Dell going from the depths of despair in 2005 when it was Dell hell to actually being, in many cases, my poster child example of how a company can transform itself and really embrace these kind of technologies and craft them into a social strategy. So I want to talk about a little bit how you actually find and support those revolutionaries. Many of them are in this room again, but there will be other people inside too. I think the most important thing is to find the people who are most passionate about developing those relationships with the customers and the people you want to reach. I'm often asked, do you want the CEO to blog, sort of like Bob Lutz at GM? Do you find someone like Lino? It doesn't matter. Whoever is the most passionate person about developing relationships, who can think in the mindset, who is completely customer-centric, is the person you want. You probably can know who this person is. You're probably thinking in your mind, it's a person who's always railing over there in customer service saying, you don't do enough for our customers. Well, let that person do something for their customers. The second thing is you have to educate your executives, and this can be a long and painful process, but there's nothing like getting them into these environments, getting them to use them, even if it's an artificial sort of Facebook on Fridays kind of thing. There's nothing like getting those hands dirty, but also giving them an idea of what are the benefits. It's not just educating them about technology, but the benefits of how these technologies can really help them meet real business objectives. The third thing is important to put somebody in charge, somebody who is important, who has a lot of responsibility. So at Dell, they put Lionel, they put the head of PR there. Michael Dell was actually involved. So up and down the line, it wasn't something they just sort of shunted off to George over there because George, while he had some extra time on his hands, he can take care of the social media stuff. We got to kind of wonder, why does George have extra time? So he's probably not the best person. You got to put somebody important in charge and make sure there are metrics and hold that person accountable. Also, I think it's important to define a box because there are policies and processes that need to be defined. And oftentimes legal has to get involved. So telling legal, for example, these are the things we will do, we won't do. Spelling out for them the most disastrous things that could happen and giving them an idea of how you're going to mitigate those risks. Those are all processes, again, that really help move things forward. And then also I talk about making things safe to fail, or at least safer to fail. Because I guarantee you that as you go into this, the companies are very risk averse. And I guarantee you that you will fail at this. There will be blow-ups. There will be situations will be uncomfortable. There'll be mistakes. And the question is, how can you increase the risk tolerance of a company so they can understand this? Now, if you look at Dell, they really screwed up on that blog in the beginning. It was a really bad mess up. But they came back. And what's amazing about the groundswell is that it's very forgiving, as long as you're honest about it, and as long as you're transparent about it. And companies oftentimes say, well, we can't have negative comments, we can't have things go wrong, because it may make us look bad. Well, not participating and not responding makes it look even worse. So a couple words of final advice, and then I'll take some questions. I think in order to, again, my theme for today was in order to make that revolution stick, the one that we're already experiencing and seeing today happening, you have to have some of these frameworks and the processes. Because the people coming into it now feel really uncertain, they're really thrown off balance and off kilter, they don't completely understand this. And I think, again, the post process could be a foundation for that. The second thing is you have to start small, but think big. What I mean by that is all the revolutionaries that you saw here had an idea and a vision of where they could take this. But they all started out with a server under their desk or personal initiative, and they iterated over and over again because they failed over and over again. failure was a really key thing that we found in all the case studies we did with the book, in that these people were constantly trying to figure out what works and doesn't work. And even when they figured it out, it would change underneath them again as the relationships changed. So that iteration was important, but they all had an idea what this potentially could become. The third thing is that if you're working inside the company, don't isolate your social strategy. The worst thing you could do is to say, let's have this little skunk works over to the side over here, and they'll figure out what the social strategy is and bring it back and tell everyone else and enlighten everybody. I strongly believe that in a customer-centric organization, everybody needs to be thinking about this, and everybody can be involved in it. They may not be actually writing the blog post, but they can be monitoring the blogs. They could be supporting the customers. They could be embracing it and bringing back that information back in. So social strategy isn't, again, just the responsibility of the executive or the community manager. It's of every single employee, because frankly, it's everywhere that you go. Anytime their employee actually goes out there, is talking to people, interacting with somebody, it's again another opportunity to be social in a technology way. And then finally, you have to be patient, because cultural change does take time. We're talking about a transformation here, a revolution. The Revolutionary War began in maybe in 1776, but it didn't end for another 12 years after that. And the same thing with Dell, it took them 2 years to really get to the point where they were really embracing these kind of changes, and as an organization really thought that this was really going to become a change. So this is my contact information if you'd like to follow up with me afterwards. Also, again, as I mentioned, the slides will be on SlideShare so you can access them. At this point, I'll take questions, if there are any. Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Cheryl Conti. I'm from Fleischman Hillard. I'm the lead digital strategist on the West Coast, and I have a lot of clients who are launching blogs. And of course, they have all of the corporate angst of, you know, how are we going to, you know, show and prove our success, and how are we going to make it a success? So what are your recommendations for some of my clients who want to understand, well, you know, how are we going to show that this has really made an impact?
Yeah, I've done some research on the ROI of blogging. It's a great question. We get asked this all the time. And the interesting thing about our blogs in particular is those five objectives that I talk about, you can use a blog to do any of those five things. And depending on which of those objectives that you want, you would use different metrics. So if it's listening better, what kind of insights do I have? Am I reducing costs on focus groups? If it's talking, am I getting people to talk back? Am I reaching more people than I would have? Am I engaging with them? And so the metrics might be comments back, and maybe number of users, and maybe subscribers that I have. It may be energizing. Well, is it actually resulting in sales? Tends not to be the case, because it's more indirect. Supporting, am I answering people's questions and reducing things? The comments that people have. HP has a great laser jet blog. They're not selling laser jets through that blog. They're supporting the people who already bought laser jets. Well, it's a combination of supporting them, but also energizing them to buy more ink cartridges. And then embracing, GM actually uses blogs to get feedback on their cars in the comments. And they've actually pulled some of the most frequent commenters and the most enlightened people who comment on their blogs and made them GM insiders and brought them onto the campus to give them feedback directly. So there are many different uses of blogs. It's almost like saying, how do I measure the impact of a website? Because in many ways, that's what a blog is. But it's a different way of talking to people. So I hope that helps. There's no single one answer.
That was great. Thank you.
Okay. Next question.
Do you have any pointers for companies that there's departments that want to connect with their market, which in this case would be patients, but they're scared to death because they're in a regulated industry such as big pharma or medical device manufacturers?
Some of the most active clients that we're working with now are in pharma and in financial services, because they are restricted in so many ways to the way that they can do direct-to-consumer, DTC or DTP. So one of the great things about having a blog is the people who would actually be writing it know exactly. There's actually a pretty short list of things they can and cannot do. It's primarily around adverse effects that they have to be careful of. But there are many companies that are trying to experiment with this because they see it as a way, potentially in private communities where it's not public, through registration, other things that they can do to actually make that work. Next question.
Hi, you've spoken a lot about larger companies, you know, very mature ones. So I was wondering if you had any insight for smaller companies or even startups to foster this type of environment.
Yeah, and the flip side of that is also B2B. And I think there's a great opportunity here because it's much more focused on a particular target rather than sort of spreading across. One of my favorite examples is Emerson Process. So they have a small blog that's written by Jim Cahill, and he's just somebody in the marketing PR department, and he decided that rather than selling the product, he was going to bring up all these different experts within the organization and really showcase them in terms of thought leadership. The other great thing about all of these social media is they're highly linked. And so you get great search engine optimization. That's a key thing that oftentimes people can justify that just right off the bat to say, you know, for all of our SEO efforts, all the search marketing efforts, we can just rise to the very top on keywords because of our social media efforts too.
Through, I'd say, the middle of last year, a number of companies were jumping into 3D multi-user virtual environments, avatar-driven spaces like Second Life with big extravagant builds. And a Wired magazine article really, I think, took the wind out of the sails a lot of those efforts. Do you think that there are interesting things happening with, apart from kids, with grown-ups in those spaces and companies should be exploring them, or is it a place to be avoided right now?
I think it's a place to be avoided, frankly, from these large marketing-oriented spends. Because frankly, going to Second Life, where are the people? Not there. So it's a very unique environment. It's not to say it's not valid. And I think there's actually some very, very good uses for virtual worlds, for the metaverse, so to speak, inside corporations, inside enterprises, or inside formed groups. Because they can go online as a group, hundreds of people would interact in a way they could never in a room like this. Imagine if we were sitting in a virtual world. You guys all have thoughts right now. You're thinking about things, and you could share those thoughts simultaneously with each other versus being in a cone of silence listening to me. That's a totally different experience, listening to a speech or going to a conference than you could have. But amongst strangers who randomly kind of connect with each other, it's not the best environment for that. So there's a place and time for that, but it's again, the wrong objective to use a marketing objective inside those worlds.
Yeah. You said that change comes slowly. It's cultural change, patience. And you pointed out what I saw, two techniques for internal revolutionaries. One was the wiki, and I would call that stealth adoption, kind of under the radar, and it's successful, and then talk rather than planning it to death before. And the other is sort of education, the Facebook Fridays, get your hands dirty. Do you have others? Other tips for the internal revolutionaries toolbox?
Yeah, I have a whole bunch of them in the book. But let me share a couple of them with you. Again, I think executive input. I'm actually going out there and actually I'm back. Going next in a few weeks to a media company, very large media company, and I've been giving them a series of a similar speech like this, and the executives would hear it, and they get excited about it. They go back and try to translate it to their employees, and they couldn't do it. So I'm actually going back and giving a speech to 8,000 employees, every single employee, because they believe, again, that in this idea that it's going to be a social strategy everyone has to have. And so I think, again, it's about communicating it, getting people living it every single day. The Wikipedia idea is so powerful because it's something that comes up from the bottom. But also within my organization, we actually are pushing everything to the wiki now, to our own sort of internal wikis and external wikis. And if it's not in the wiki, it doesn't exist. So some people are actually forcing it down by saying, okay, I'm not going to see this in an email. If it's sent in an email, I'm not going to look at it. I want to see it in a wiki or in our collaboration software. So there are lots of different techniques around, especially around collaboration internally to make this happen. It's the marketing external things that get a little bit harder because you're really bucking up against some very long-held beliefs around brand and control and marketing that really need to go out the window. I oftentimes say that marketing departments have this figurine of a customer sitting in the middle of the conference table in their department. And if it doesn't look like that, the customer kind of doesn't look and smell and act the way they anticipate the customer will, they don't want to talk to them. And in fact, oftentimes, marketing departments keep things at a distance and want to keep that customer far away because they want to keep it pristine. Well, it's messy. They do awful things to your brand. They mash it up. They put it up on YouTube. They destroy it. They make it their own. They internalize it. They make widgets around it and post it onto their Facebook page. And all those things are actually good. Because whenever somebody interacts with the brand in the way that they want to, that's better than no interaction at all. And so I think it's a mindset that we're going to have to see happening. And frankly, I say to people, to the executives, if you don't feel a little bit queasy in your stomach, you're probably not moving fast enough. You really need to feel uncomfortable. And the reason why is because these are relationships. And all of us have been in relationships. And they're never clear. They're never certain. And they're never constant. And so if you're not kind of off kilter, it's not going to move forward at all. Any other questions? I see nobody out there. A couple more. Yeah, go ahead. If you could speak into the microphone because they're recording, that'd be great.
Excuse me. Too late last night.
I hear you.
My question's about internal to companies instead of external to companies. And this also is a struggle, is trying to convince internal leadership about putting social community. They want Facebook, but they want it inside the company. Any thoughts on what you're seeing other people do? A lot of that's outward facing, you talked about. What do you
see? Yeah, again, the social networks, communities, all these things can happen internally. I gave two examples of that, Best Buy and Intel. But Everything A, Razorfish, has a great wiki blog. In fact, they and Organic have actually taken their existing intranet, thrown it all out, and put it on these platforms. And there are, I think at this point, my colleague Jeremiah Aoyang has a growing list of social networking providers, community providers. There are like 80 or 100 on his list so far. There are many, many different options, including open source options like Drupal, that are just absolutely fantastic. So there's no reason why you can't build it internally. The hard part isn't the technology. It's really, again, getting people to stop doing these old bad habits of sending everything by email to go onto these collaboration tools. And that's collaboration. But there's also this mindset of letting go of control. Like SharePoint, you have to do everything by department. The permissions are already stacked in there. What if you could actually let anybody talk to anybody in an organization? And I ask CTOs this all the time, like, what are you afraid of? I mean, this is inside your firewall. What are you afraid of? They go, wow, you know, what about product development and all these secrets, ideas? And I go, okay, gate that part off. But everything else, why wouldn't you want free-flowing information, expertise location, better sharing of information, a social network with profiles, and people understanding tacitly and implicitly what people are doing? Why wouldn't you want that? And they kind of go, yeah. You have to focus again on those benefits. Focus on the benefits and the things that you can do rather than the technologies. You sell that vision, the technology part becomes easy. And frankly, it's so low cost, you can justify probably a beta investment. Again, start small with one department. Make the use case for 1 month. Add another department in another 2 weeks. So you can accelerate this. We're not talking about a six-month beta test. Shame on you for proposing that, but it should be pretty quick and easy to get these things going.
Hi, my name is Michelle Greer. I write a business-to-business marketing blog, and I've encouraged customers to, or our merchants to ask for feedback, and it seems like they're always wanting to get feedback. They want the feedback. They want the reviews, but they don't know how to get it. So companies like Dell, and especially Salesforce, I mean, you hear about how they, you know, so many of the features in Salesforce come from Salesforce users. What sort of strategies do they deploy to really get people, you know, turned on to the idea of like, hey, you know, I can actually contribute to this product just by saying I don't like this or I like this?
Well, they both do this wonderful thing, but they give feedback. Again, they're using the same platform. It's a little bit easy. But if I go back to, I'm not going to find it, but it's if you go back to actually the page where the saw banner is, it says implemented. And on the Dell side too, when something gets implemented, they write about it on the blog. And they say, hey, this new feature has come out on this laptop. It's better screen resolution. It was proposed by these four people in comments and also on IdeaStorm. So they're closing the loop and showing that, yeah, you do have an impact. There's nothing better to encourage participation than to show that it actually matters. It makes a difference.
Thank you.
Hi there. You mentioned before the benefits for SEO, very briefly, for the social media strategy. That's something that I need to talk to a number of my clients about. Could you just expand a little on that?
Yeah. One of the things that search engines do, obviously, is to weight inbound links. Mm-hmm. And the social media space, especially on blogs, is all about linking out and people linking to you. And so to join that goodness and everything, and I strongly encourage blogs to be on the main domain of the site because of that. Right. You can raise the goodness of the overall page rank of a particular site using these. And there's simple things like instead of having clever titles for a blog post, put keywords into your blog post. This is an H1 and title page.
Yeah.
So just really simple social media optimization tools out there to do these, and it will shoot right to the top.
And do it within the URL of the website.
Ideally.
Not externally.
Ideally.
Yeah. Okay.
Hi there. You spoke about wikis and you spoke about blogs. I'm curious to hear, there's so many different platforms and tools out there, and there's probably dozens of new startups at this conference. What are, you know, there's Twitter, Flickr, Bizarre Voice, et cetera. What are the things other than those two particular platforms that you're most excited about?
You know, Bizarre Voice is one of my favorite companies out there, ratings and reviews. There's lots of good monitoring tools. Ones excited about are like BuzzLogic, which looks at influence, and Visible Technologies, which looks gives you a dashboard to spread all that goodness throughout the organization. They're all really good, but you know the one that I keep coming back to that people kind of look at me like I have crossed eyes or something is forms and bulletin boards. And people look at me, but that's not Web 2.0 technologies. And I go, well, it doesn't have the whiz-bang and everything about it, but it is a really good, robust tool where you can take the new version of that, which is question and answers. And so these are basically ways for people to connect with each other and support each other. And forums are, and wikis have been around for a long, long time. And it's not about the technologies, it's about how you use them. So many companies have forums and bulletin boards. But I guarantee you, what they say is, I have my bulletin boards over here, my customers really like talking to each other. I'm like, oh, how often do you go over there? They say, oh, we can't go over there. That's a customer space. It's sacred. It's, you know, we can't get our, you know, involved in that. We'll wreck it. I'm like, but it's your bulletin board. They're here to talk to you, and you're ignoring them. They have problems, and you're ignoring them. And I thought Dell, Bob Pearson, had a great point. He made this analogy. He was like, how dare you, as an organization, see somebody who has a problem over there and not help them? It's like a doctor standing outside in the parking lot of a hospital and not going in to help those patients. You have to. When you see your customers talking about things, you need to get involved. It may not be on your side. It could be on other sites. But I think that's it's a different type of mindset, again, that companies don't feel comfortable really, truly talking to their customers in a free-flowing environment which they do not control. So I hope that helps. Any last questions out there? All right. Well, I'll be around for the conference for the duration today. Again, my information is up on these slides. And if you have any questions, please let me know.